imagine sitting in like a high stakes meeting, right? And your entire job completely depends on understanding the presentation.
Yeah, that sounds pretty stressful already.
Right, but there is a catch. The speaker is delivering this critical information entirely in a language you only started learning maybe 6 months ago.
Oh, wow. So your brain is just working overtime.
Exactly. You're burning this incredible amount of the calories just trying to translate the title on the first slide. And meanwhile, the speaker is, you know, already moving on to slide 4.
And you're completely lost.
Completely. You can feel your heart rate going up. You're experiencing massive cognitive overload. And today, well, we are looking at a masterclass blueprint on exactly how to prevent that.
It's a really fascinating approach.
It really is. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are exploring a framework from a document titled Working with Others, March 2025. And it outlines 10 incredibly intentional strategies for supporting EL students. That's English as an additional language.
And, you know, while the context of this document is education, the underlying mechanics we are going to explore today are entirely universal.
Right. They apply to almost any team setting.
Exactly. Because what we are really looking at here is a highly structured collaborative ecosystem. It's basically a blueprint for how a diverse group of adults, so teachers, teaching assistants, wider staff, and families can perfectly sync up.
Sync up to support someone who is, you know, trying to process complex, high-level information in a language they just haven't fully mastered yet.
Right. The ultimate goal here is preventing that cognitive overload and fostering true inclusion.
Yeah. And this isn't just a list of like generic teaching tips. It's a really deep look at true inclusion. It's about ensuring you are never leaving someone behind simply because they don't have the vocabulary quite yet.
Mm-hmm.
And what struck me immediately in this document is that before a student even attempts to learn, before the bell even rings for the day, the adults in the room have to be perfectly aligned.
They absolutely do. The source text puts a massive emphasis on collaborative planning, specifically between the teacher and the teaching assistant, or TA.
Right. Okay, let's unpack this, because the document is very explicit about the necessity of a focused pre-lesson briefing, isn't it?
It is. It makes the argument that support in a learning environment cannot be reactive. It has to be fiercely proactive.
Like you can't just figure it out on the fly.
Exactly. The teacher and the TA need to sit down and identify not just the activity the students are doing, but the specific granular language demands of that upcoming lesson.
Let's make that concrete, because I really want to avoid just reading a table of contents here.
Sure.
If you think about a professional kitchen, right? You have a head chef and a sous chef. If they only start communicating about the menu while the oil is actively burning in the pan,
the dish is already ruined.
Exactly. It's too late. They have to prep their ingredients, their mise en place, before the restaurant even opens. The pre-briefing is the flight plan.
I like that culinary analogy, because what's fascinating here is how the document insists that a TA's support shouldn't just be passive observation.
Right. They aren't just standing in the back of the room.
No, it actually uses the phrase an intentional extension of teaching. And from a cognitive science standpoint, this is absolutely vital.
Why is that? Like, what's happening in the brain?
Well, when an EL learner is sitting in a classroom, their brain is doing double duty. They are trying to understand the core subject. Let's say it's the process of photosynthesis or dividing fractions.
Okay.
But they are simultaneously trying to decode and translate the English words being spoken. That is an enormous cognitive load.
It's like running two heavy software programs at the same time.
Yes. And without a coordinated plan between the adults, that student will simply shut down. The system crashes.
Which brings us to how we actually prepare the student's brain to receive this content before the lesson even really begins. The source talks extensively about pre-teaching vocabulary.
Yes, point 2 in the framework.
Right. They suggest identifying both the subject-specific terminology and the functional everyday language required for the lesson and introducing it early.
Yeah.
But I have a practical question here.
Go ahead.
How does a TA actually pre-teach that vocabulary if they don't fluently speak the student's home language? I mean, are they just pointing at flashcards and hoping for the best?
No, it is much more sophisticated than just pointing at flashcards. The framework emphasizes using highly targeted visual aids, dual language resources, and repetition strategies.
Okay.
It ties into something called dual coding theory.
Dual coding theory.
Yeah. When a TA shows a student an image of a plant cell alongside the English word chloroplast, they are creating a visual peg in the student's mind.
Oh, I see. So it connects the word to a picture.
Right. And that image bypasses the brain's language processing center and implants the concept directly. By embedding this vocabulary early, sometimes even sending it home with families the night before, you ensure the student isn't cognitively overwhelmed.
Because they already have the foundational building blocks.
Exactly. It allows them to actually engage with the complex science or math concept when the core lesson starts.
Okay, so the ingredients are prepped, the adults know their roles, and the student has those visual pegs established. But eventually, you know, you actually have to cook the meal.
You have to deliver the content.
You have to cross that language barrier during the lesson without leaving the student stranded. Mm. And this brings us to a part of the document that I found really provocative.
The use of the home language.
Yes. It advocates heavily for using the student's home language as a bridge.
It does. It places immense value on recognizing the student's first language not as a deficit, but as a massive asset.
Right.
The framework suggests incorporating bilingual dictionaries, translation tools, and peer support to allow students to process difficult ideas in their strongest language first.
Before carefully transitioning them into English. Now, wait a minute. Let me push back on this, because I think a lot of people hearing this would find it counterintuitive. Well, if the ultimate goal of the education system is to teach these students English, doesn't letting them use their home language just act as a crutch? Like, are we just delaying their progress by not forcing them to immerse themselves immediately?
That is a very common assumption, and it is entirely wrong according to both cognitive science and this framework.
Wait, really? Entirely wrong?
Yes. The first language is never a crutch. It is a foundation. Let's look at the mechanics of learning here. Losing conceptual understanding is a much, much bigger risk to a child's development than delayed English vocabulary.
Okay, walk me through that.
Imagine you are teaching a complex physics concept, like gravity or velocity. If the student completely misses the underlying physics because they didn't understand the English explanation, you have failed on two fronts.
They didn't learn the science and they didn't learn the English.
Exactly.
Ah, I see. So you let them grasp the massive abstract idea in the language their brain already processes fluently.
Yes, because this raises an important question about how we define academic success. Is success just rote memorization of English words?
No, probably not.
Right, no. It's about confidence, critical thinking, and conceptual grasp. When a student understands the physics concept in their home language, you have secured the core knowledge.
You're securing the payload before you change the delivery vehicle.
That's a great way to put it. Then, as the document details, the teacher and TA work together to carefully map the English vocabulary onto that secured concept.
That makes total sense. And the text pairs this concept with what it calls scaffolded instructions and modeling, right?
Yes, breaking tasks down into highly manageable steps, using incredibly concise language and supporting everything with physical demonstrations.
And here again, the intentional role of the TA is critical. The framework outlines how the TA should dynamically rephrase the teacher's instructions.
And constantly check for understanding. They explicitly model what a successful outcome looks like.
So if the task is to write a paragraph, the TA doesn't just tell them to write.
No, they show them a completed paragraph. Then, as the student's confidence grows, the adults gradually remove those scaffolds to force independent practice.
Okay, so understanding the concept in your head, whether that happens in your home language or through a beautifully scaffolded English explanation, is really only half the battle.
Right.
Because eventually, you have to output. You have to speak. And if you've ever tried to learn a new language on an app like Duolingo, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh, absolutely.
Reading the words on the screen is one thing. But the second the app turns on your microphone and asks you to speak the phrase out loud, you completely freeze.
It's terrifying.
It is. Speaking aloud in a new language is where true fluency meets a massive wall of anxiety.
Which leads to a massive spike in the affective filter. Anxiety literally blocks learning.
Hold on. Affective filter. Is that like a psychological wall that goes up when a student panics?
Yeah.
Explain the mechanism there, because that sounds really important.
It is crucial. In cognitive linguistics, the affective filter is essentially an emotional barrier. When a person feels stressed, self-conscious, or anxious, like when they're asked to speak a new language in front of 30 peers, their amygdala, the brain's threat detection center hijacks their cognitive resources.
Oh, wow. So it's a physical response.
Literally. The brain blocks input and output from reaching the language acquisition centers. If the affective filter is high, no learning happens.
Which is why the document places such a heavy emphasis on amygdala. Which just means structured talk opportunities.
Exactly. You cannot simply hope a student will raise their hand and speak. You have to deliberately engineer a low-stress environment for it.
The document mentions using strategies like think, pair, share, providing sentence stems, and using guided discussion prompts. I was trying to think of a good analogy for this.
What'd you come up with?
Well, it's like asking someone to improvise a jazz solo when they're still trying to memorize the basic fingering of the scales on their saxophone.
Right, you can't just throw them on stage.
Exactly. You have to give them the sheet music first. That's what a sentence stem is, right? It's the sheet music.
That is an excellent way to conceptualize it. Providing a sentence stem, giving the student the first three or four words of their response, does something remarkable in the brain.
What does it do?
It outsources the structural grammar. If the student doesn't have to worry about conjugating the verb or finding the right preposition to start the sentence, their brain is free.
Free to just focus on the vocabulary.
Yes, entirely on retrieving the specific vocabulary word they need to finish the thought. It lowers the cognitive load and keeps that effective filter from spiking.
And so you let them rehearse what they're going to say using that sentence stem in a pair or very small group where the stakes are incredibly low.
Yes. And what is happening during that guided practice is deliberate.
The TA is right there, right?
Exactly. The framework points out that the TA is right there listening and modeling accurate language structures. The adults are showing the students the actual architecture of a good sentence.
So they can articulate their thinking clearly.
Right. Only after the student has built that fluency and confidence in the small, safe group are they encouraged to use the language independently in a whole glass discussion.
It is a beautifully staged progression from input to output. But, I mean, let's be realistic here. No system is flawless.
Of course not.
Even with the best pre-briefing in the morning, the best visual scaffolding, and the best guided practice, gaps are going to emerge. A student is going to play a wrong note. So how does this framework catch them when they stumble?
It creates a highly responsive safety net, and it does this through two main avenues: targeted interventions and the physical environment itself.
Let's look at the interventions first. The document outlines using targeted small group sessions.
Yes, but I want to be clear. These are not random, generic, extra help sessions where kids just do more worksheets.
What are they, then?
They are highly surgical. They begin with careful assessment to identify a specific gap. Maybe a student fundamentally misunderstands past tense verbs, or they missed a core set of vocabulary words from the science unit.
And these intervention sessions are described as short, structured, and purposeful.
Yes, and the key mechanism here is the feedback loop. The progress made in those small, focused sessions is fed directly back into the whole class teaching strategy for the next day.
Oh, that's smart.
It's a continuous loop of assessment, intervention, and reintegration back into the main ecosystem.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me, though. That makes sense for the active teaching side. But the document also talks at length about the inclusive classroom environment. And as I read through those strategies, I realized that the physical environment itself is doing silent heavy lifting.
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, the framework talks about ensuring representation through multilingual displays, culturally diverse resources, and, you know, inclusive materials on the shelves.
Right.
Think about what that does to a person's brain when they walk into a room. Even if no adult is actively speaking to that student at that exact moment, the room itself is communicating to them.
That's a really good point.
The posters on the wall, the books available, they are passively telling the student, you belong here. Your identity is valid in this space. It reminds me of having a background app open on your phone.
Oh, draining the battery.
Exactly. If you feel alienated or vigilant, that app is constantly running, draining your battery.
That is a profound insight. If we connect this to the broader picture of cognitive bandwidth, inclusion directly impacts raw processing power.
So it's not just about being nice, it's functional.
Completely functional. When a student feels marginalized or anxious about their identity, a significant portion of their brain's energy is consumed by stress and vigilance.
Right.
By celebrating cultural diversity through curriculum links and multilingual displays, you are systematically closing those battery-draining background apps. You are creating psychological safety.
Which frees up the resources.
Yes. When students feel valued and secure, their cognitive resources are freed up to actually do the incredibly hard work of learning a new language.
The environment literally changes their brain chemistry to make learning easier.
It does. And the framework pairs this environmental support with strategic grouping, deliberately sitting ELL learners next to highly supportive, empathetic peers.
So they can develop language organically without an adult hovering over them.
Exactly. So we have the lesson planned proactively, the content scaffolded conceptually, the speaking practice safely, and the classroom environment optimized psychologically.
But a student's learning doesn't magically stop at the classroom door when the bell rings.
No, it doesn't.
To sustain this kind of deep progress, the support system has to expand outward. It has to expand to the wider institution and, most importantly, to the home.
Right. Section 5 of this document details a really comprehensive approach to expanding this ecosystem.
I want to trace how data actually travels in this model. Let's say a student really struggled to grasp the concept of photosynthesis during the afternoon lesson. What happens next?
It triggers a continuous loop. It starts with consistent feedback between the staff. There are immediate post-lesson check-ins where the TA informs the teacher that the student struggled with that specific concept.
Okay, so the communication is immediate.
Yes. The teacher then dynamically adapts tomorrow's lesson to revisit it. But it goes beyond just the teacher and the TA. Point 10 in the framework highlights multi-agency and staff collaboration.
What does that look like?
Well, the teacher might take that data point to the SENCO, or the EEL coordinator, or the pastoral team.
Hey, let me pause you there.
Yeah.
And SENCO, what does that specific role actually do in this ecosystem?
So SENCO stands for Special Educational Needs Coordinator. Their role in this ecosystem is critical because they look beneath the surface.
Beneath the surface of the language barrier.
Exactly. Sometimes a student is struggling not just because they're learning a new language, but because they have an underlying learning difference, like dyslexia or an auditory processing delay.
Oh, I see.
The staff shares information so they can distinguish between a language barrier and a learning need. This ensures the student experiences a coherent support system across all their classes, not just in one isolated room.
So what does this all mean for the data path? The data travels from the TA to the teacher to the sensing. And then there are the families.
Yes, point 4.
The document stresses regular communication with the home, using translation tools and apps to make sure the communication is actually accessible. But the part that really struck me was the explicit emphasis on fostering two-way communication.
That is a vital distinction in the text. It is not just the school acting as an authority, dictating progress reports to the parents.
Right. When I read that, I thought about how often in life we think of updates as a one-way broadcast. We tell our clients, our team members, or our kids' parents what is happening, and we assume our job is done.
But it's not.
No. But this framework explicitly invites families to share their own insights about their child's needs, their moods, and their experiences at home.
Mm-hmm.
The educators are actively asking for intelligence from the ground to make their classroom strategies better.
It is institutional humility in practice. The framework acknowledges a simple truth. The family possesses crucial data about that child that the school fundamentally lacks.
Which is so important.
By sharing practical strategies for the home, like encouraging the family to read together or discuss complex topics in their native language, and by truly listening to the family's feedback, the school creates a powerful partnership.
It strengthens the continuity between the home environment and the school environment.
Exactly.
It basically creates an unbroken chain of reinforcement. The word photosynthesis travels from the TA to the teacher to the SENPALGO to the parents' translation app and becomes a dinner table conversation in the student's home language.
And that unbroken chain is really the ultimate takeaway from the source text's reflective summary. True support cannot be piecemeal. It requires a holistic approach.
Linguistic, academic, and social.
Yes. When you have this level of intentional collaboration, clear communication, and a shared commitment to psychological inclusion among all the adults, the student doesn't just learn English faster.
They feel valued.
They feel valued, confident, and fully seen. That is the true engine of sustained progress.
You know, as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to bring this whole concept back to you listening right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if you never step foot inside a classroom, and even if you never work with an EL student, this document offers a profound lesson in how human beings process information and interact with one another.
It really does.
Think about the mechanics we just explored. Pre-briefing your team so everyone knows their exact role before the pressure hits. Scaffolding complex tasks so you don't overwhelm the people relying on you.
Right.
Building an environment where people feel psychologically safe enough to speak up without their affective filter spiking. These are completely universal skills for managing a team, communicating with a partner, or just helping a confused neighbor.
They are the hallmarks of empathy and effective communication in literally any setting.
And I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. building on that idea of using a home language to secure a concept. The document brilliantly suggests letting a student grasp a complex idea in their native tongue before transitioning them to English. This way, they don't lose the underlying meaning.
Exactly. Securing the payload.
Right. Makes you wonder how much of our everyday professional communication is actually just a second language of corporate jargon.
Oh, that's a great point.
When you introduce a complex new strategy or a big change to your team, or even a new routine to your family, are you scaffolding their understanding?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Are you letting them grasp the core concept in plain human language first? Or are you just throwing a bunch of buzzwords at them and hoping they can translate it correctly on the fly?
While their cognitive battery drains.
Exactly. Something to think about the next time you draft an email, lead a meeting, or try to explain something difficult to someone you care about. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.